you, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to New Books in Technology. As our guest today, we'll have Andrew L. Russell, who is an assistant professor of history and the director of the program in science and technology studies in the College of Arts and Letters at the Stevens Institute of Technology in Hoboken, New Jersey. Hello, Dr. Russell. How are you?
Hi, great. Thanks. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you for coming on the show today. So you've written a book that's coming out very soon called Open Standards and the Digital Age. So openness, it's one of those buzzwords we're starting to hear a lot about lately. Can you explain openness to us?
Well, thanks, first of all, for having me on. You're right. There's a lot of buzz around openness and its ally, transparency. It's one of these values that everyone wants to aspire to, but we're seeing example after example of powerful people, powerful institutions coming up a little bit short of the rhetoric of pure openness and transparency. And so as a historian, there's something really interesting there, that tension there, the gap between the rhetoric and the reality that's useful for historians to explore. So the way that I enter into this subject is by looking at openness in digital networks, in particular, in the rhetoric of openness in digital networks. Before getting into that, it's useful to observe that rhetoric, as you say, is all over the place. So I start the book with examples of open science, open government, open innovation, open access publishing. The list is actually pretty astonishing once you assemble the list of open libraries. Right. So the librarians are up in arms about this. And so they have some things in common. There's a bunch of different definitions of openness, and there's a lot of work that's gone into talking about that. But I think it's useful to start from the common points that they have. First, the internet's driving it, right? That in a lot of these movements, they didn't exist or not in this form before the internet. Second, it's a openness in my reading contains a vision about that comes from participatory democracy. It's a political statement. It says more and more people can get involved in controlling something, whatever it is. So if it's science or innovation or government or what have you. And this includes commitments to things like due process and transparency and so on. So we've got technology, we've got politics. There's an economic aspect to this that I think is really important too, that we don't hear so much in the free and open rhetoric, but historically it's a really powerful driver. And that's advocates of openness, and in particular open networks and open standards, which is what I'm interested in, insist that part of the idea is to support a vibrant market. To support things like entrepreneurship, low barriers to entry, and to oppose centralized power and centralized control. So the historical institutions that I look at, particularly IBM and AT&T, but a lot of the contemporary discussions are about whether it's the NSA or Google or Facebook or pick your villain of the week. That remains the same. So we've got technology, we've got politics, we've got economics, and then the cultural thread through this is a sort of narrative of progress that is familiar to people who think about technology and technological history. Progress is on their side, basically, and so there's a sort of zeal. A lot of people characterize this as a religious zeal that drives advocates of openness. That's how I see it. I don't want to be a referee in deciding whose definition of open is the best or who's more open than someone else. I'm a historian, and I'm interested in seeing what their language says about how they see the world.
Sure. Sure. Now, you mentioned a lot of things. Well, first of all, this is a technology book, but it's a history of technology oriented. But also, you mentioned policy and economics as well. So what are the benefits of an interdisciplinary study of a topic such as openness and open standards?
Yeah, so, I mean, the main thing for me is is where do, you know, I think all of us who do interdisciplinary work are most successful and most coherent. And I know this from experience when we focus on where we're coming from. And so for professional and disciplinary reasons, as well as this intellectual reason, I think it's important to remember that I'm a historian. And so I look at these things historically. And of course, there's a tradition, the history of technology and the history of computing, that looks at these developments in the ways that I've described. Now, as soon as you start taking this history of technology seriously, you realize that you can't rule out those other perspectives, right? So, of course, the history of technology is going to include some economic things and cultural history, gender history, other things like that. And so, so it's kind of our burden to be able to weigh all of those things and still be coherent. The exciting thing about writing this book, which is a little bit different from writing my dissertation, so maybe I should just say a word about that. This grows out of my dissertation in a history of science, technology, medicine program. And when one is writing a dissertation, you know, there's an audience of 1 to 4 or 5 people.
Right.
And so that was easier in some senses than figuring out how to write this for a broader audience or this dream, you know, academics have of reaching the masses. You know, I don't know about that, but, you know, a lot of people care about these topics. Economists really care about these topics. People who care about the internet and the future of the internet care about things like power and control in the internet. And so our instinct is to, as historians, is to, you know, sort of hide in the academy, hide in history and only talk to our peers, our colleagues. And that's useful to a certain extent, but the real challenge is to, you know, how do I open up, so to speak, the audience and engage them too. So it was a tricky process. I don't know if I got it right. I guess the readers will tell me, but that's some of the interest in directing it in that way.
Oh, great. Now, if we want to get into the actual subject matter, just for the uninitiated, could you explain what standards are and what is standardization?
Well, yeah, that's a tricky question to answer. There's a good XKCD comic where they two guys come together and they say, well, we've got 13 standards for something. What are we going to do? And then they decide to come up with another standard. So now they've got 14 standards. And there's a, you know, another way that we characterize the complexity of this is it's Andrew Tannenbaum, who wrote a computer networking textbook in the early 80s. And he said something along the lines of, you know, if you don't like the standards we have today, just wait until next week or next year and you'll get a new one. So there's two things. There's standards and there's standardization. And a standard is usually refers to a document, some specified way of doing something in a particular way, right? And it's fixed. And it's supposed to be unchanging, although in reality, these things change over time. I find it useful, in the introduction I get into this a little bit, useful to distinguish between three different types of standards. One is a measurement standard. So things like a meter or a pound, some sort of objective unit of measure. And there's a really good literature on that in the history of science in particular, about where the meter comes from or where the ohm comes from, the measure of resistance. So that's one. A second is what we can think of as performance standards. So if we want a system or a process to perform in a certain way, and so a good example of those is the ISO 9000 standards for quality control. We want, say, a production of a product like a chair to meet certain quality standards, but they don't want to go in and tell the manufacturer how they should make the chair. They just want to make sure that the chair doesn't fall over, you know, is comfortable, whatever comfortable means, and that sort of thing. So it can either, these performance standards can either specify a process for making something or an outcome. You know, so you need to follow these steps or it just needs to do this and not that. And so safety standards are good examples of certain types of performance standards or design standards. So we've got measurement, we've got performance, and then we've got the third kind, which is what I'm most interested in talking about networks, and that's compatibility planning. So how do we connect things together? And this characterizes things in, analog things, so screws and nuts, for example. What's the pitch of a screw thread? What's the dimension of the nut or the bolt? Is its width or length? It also refers to can capture software. So things like TCP/IP, how do we get compatibility between different computers or exchanging information over certain networks? So it's really useful to distinguish between those types of standards because there's, the French word for standard or standardization is normalization. And my French is terrible, but it's norms. Standards are norms, so it's standard to shake someone's hand. Is that the same as a standard for encryption or something? It isn't useful at a certain level of specificity to think about those things as the same. Okay, so there's three different types of standards. And like I said, I'm most interested in compatibility standards. Standardization is a process, right? A social process of fixing something.
Sure.
Or making local things universal or a little bit more universal. And so here again, I follow three different types of standardization process or trace these out. And there's a big literature on this, and I'm basically summarizing. The first type of method of making a standard is what theorists refer to as de facto standards. It just sort of happens.
Sure.
So we shake hands because it's normal. No one's telling us to do it. The second way, if you can imagine on the opposite end of the spectrum, is de jure standards. They're laws. If you don't do something, the state could kill you or at least put you in jail, to be a little less extreme or maybe fine you or something like that. These are regulations. These are pretty well known to scholars who study regulations and laws and so on. Then there's a fuzzy middle ground, which we refer to as voluntary consensus standards. And so this characterizes standards that come out of some sort of organization that doesn't have the force of law behind it. So that could be an engineering society like the IEEE. It could be some sort of NGO like ISO, the International Organization for Standardization. It could be a trade association of a different sort, just some sort of collective of companies. So, for example, the cellular telecommunications industry association, CTIA, in its standards for wireless telephony. We can't call it a de facto standard, but we can't call it a government mandated standard either. And so this is a really interesting phenomenon socially and historically. And it fits into some recent literature where coming out of business history and organization studies where people want to understand this middle ground a little bit better. So some theorists refer to it as private governance, right, is a buzzword that we hear a lot, is a useful body of literature. And also there's a big body of literature looking at standards. And so Joanne Yates and Craig Murphy have written a book on voluntary consensus standards, and they continue to work on this subject historically as I do. And there's all these practitioners who are in this world now. So people who participate in, say, the Internet Engineering Task Force or, pick somebody at a company like IBM or Google, they might go to several of these committees because they need to be involved in standards for each of those committees. So it's a long answer, but so standards are something fixed, and standardization is a way to make them fixed, or at least to garner some sort of agreement around that fixity.
Sure. Now, one of the ideas that you state in your book is that standardization can be a form of critique, a critique of ideology. Can you explain that a bit?
Sure, yeah. So this is a good example of why it's useful to write an introduction once you're finished with a body of work, once you know what it's about. This happened in my dissertation where, at the end of my dissertation, where I had looked at the process of making standards in successive communication networks. So from the telephone, wireless telephone, and then computer networks. Usually studies look at just one particular technology. They tend not to link different networks together in that historical way. And so I was kind of sitting back and thinking about it and realized that in each case, new network standards and new networks, the people who created them were doing something more than just making new stuff. When I looked at what they said they were doing and what they hoped to accomplish, there was a political and a cultural argument to what they were doing. That they were making something better than what came before. And it wasn't just better for a technical reason, it was better. Sometimes that was a political claim. Sometimes it's a moral claim. Sometimes it's an economic claim. This struck me as really significant, and I didn't really get a good handle on how to talk about that. So I was thinking about criticism and critique, which, you know, there's obviously a lot of people have thought about that. And I came across Gerald Ronick, who's a philosopher who I hadn't really encountered before. And he wrote about critique. He was kind of riffing on Michel Foucault's essay, What is Critique? And he pointed out something that I thought was really, really important, which is that criticism is sort of complaining about something, and critique is often seen as that way. It's just simply reacting to something. But there's also an element of critique that means building something anew as well. So once it's one thing to have a criticism of something, but it's kind of something different to build something as a response. And so I thought about that and then thought about the historical examples that I had studied and saw that all of the standards makers and network builders were doing that. Sometimes they were pretty explicit about it. And we see this a lot, for example, in the rhetoric of the internet, right, where AT&T was a closed system and the internet is an open end-to-end system. And so there's an argument about control and power there. It's not just that it works better. They'll talk about that too, but it does something better for society. And they're pretty explicit about it. Sometimes that argument or the critique is also implicit in the technology and in the network design and the way that it's promoted. The engineers won't always, be out in front of a conference saying my way is better because my politics are better, but it's there's implications of that. And so reading that in the sources is, kind of one of the tricks of the trade of pulling that out. But after I had thought about that, it became pretty clear that that's what my story was about. The final thing that I'll say about this, or one more thing I could say, is what really inspired me in this regard was historian Bernard Carlson. Bernie Carlson has a great essay about Gardner Hubbard, who was Alexander Graham Bell's father-in-law and sponsor. So we're talking late 1800s. Hubbard hated the Western Union Telegraph monopoly. He thought it was undemocratic. It was a monopoly. He wasn't the only one to complain about them. He was especially concerned that it deprived middle-class Americans of information they needed to be good citizens and to be active in market transactions as well. And so part of what motivated him to support Bell financially was that he had been around and around trying to regulate Western Union and lobbying for that, and he hadn't been successful. And so in Bell and with the telephone, he discovered a different strategy, which is to simply build another network, to build something better. And so the critique is both implicit and explicit in Hubbard, maybe not necessarily in Bell, but certainly in Hubbard and in the structures that Hubbard created to support the telephone. This was pretty incredible for me, actually, to realize that this is what I've been talking about. And so the nice opportunity of writing a book is to be able to foreground that a little bit more and think through it a little bit more, and maybe think through the connections that that insight might have to other forms of innovation. So once I started thinking about critique, I started thinking about Schumpeterian creative destruction, right, which I think has some common characteristics with the way that I've described critique, or the way that I understand the term through Ronick and Foucault and Carlson, which is, you know, you build something new and get rid of something old. And it's, you know, when one does that, one frames it as a sort of virtuous act. That's something that I hope people take away from the book and maybe take into other realms and take the idea seriously.
Well, in relation to that, I want to read you a quote from one of your chapters, and it says, "System builders are always engaged in ideological and discursive work, not merely technical work." So I was wondering if you could expand on perhaps that quotation.
Yeah, so that captures some of the things I was just trying to articulate, and I think shows how I've tried to embed my approach to this topic in the history of technology and the work of people like Thomas Hughes, who's written a lot about, or wrote a lot about, system builders. I teach engineers, and I work with engineers here at Stevens. And so, you know, they're really focused on their technical work, and they don't really talk about, the broader belief systems that either that surround them. Sometimes they don't really understand that themselves. You know, I think it's fair to say none of us do fully. And that they're trying to promote as well. They're doing ideological work. And so whether it's supporting, to bring it back to openness, by calling something open, that's a statement of saying this won't be subject to government censors, or the monopolists at, you know, pick your monopolist, Google, IBM, you know, whatever, Western Union. But they don't need to, you know, write a big long paper about how they hate monopolies or some sort of treatise on antitrust or anti-surveillance. Just by making something that way and calling it open, they've done that ideological work. There's a lot of people, especially doing technical things, that advance normative claims without really being fully aware of what they're doing. It's just kind of assumptions that are buried in there. And so one thing that history's useful for is to be able to take a step back from this work of innovation and newness and everything and try and evaluate that work in a deeper cultural frame and a longer frame, so we can see long-term consequences. I hope that gets at the question.
Oh yeah. Oh yes.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Good. Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. So, and you know, it there's embedded in what I'm saying is also some methodological considerations about the history of technology and the history of computing. It can have a perception of being artifact focused and inwardly focused. A bunch of people just care about, you know, different models of trains or compare, you know, different models of computers or something like that. That's not usually the case. We're cultural historians. We're interested in these broader social and cultural and political frames in which engineers and system builders lived and made. You know, there's a lot of great work in my field in that regard, and I'm simply building on that.
Great. Now, one of the things in relation to, I think, the system builders and ideological and discursive works you mentioned is that standardization is a social process by which humans come to take things for granted. So then, are we forgetting the opening ideological and discursive work? Are we just not paying attention to it? Or what's happening there?
Yeah, I think we tend to, it's easy to forget it. Because, you know, once something becomes standard, there's a great quote that I have either in the introduction or one of the early chapters of the book from an engineer in the 1920s, a guy named Albert Whitney, actually a mathematician. He wasn't an engineer. And he talks about the tension between standardization and creativity. And he says something along the lines of that standardization fixes advances. It fixes problems that have already been settled and leaves them where they belong, namely to the field of routine. And this frees the creative genius. So it frees us to be able to do things that we wouldn't otherwise be able to do. So for example, we speak English, and so we don't have to worry about how to communicate with one another. We can simply do that and then talk about ideas, right? It's when we take things for granted, then it's a double-edged sword. On the one hand, there's some advantages that come from that. We can act more efficiently or achieve greater levels of complexity. So we don't need to worry about how our computers are going to exchange video packets. It just happens, and we can have this interesting conversation. But in making something standard, and in arriving at that decision by consensus, right, this kind of third mode that I'm interested in, we're always excluding things. And we're always drawing boundaries around what's acceptable or about what's normal, in the French word, and what's not. And so it's just a sort of inevitable part of that process that things are going to be forgotten and left out and obscured. And so I think it's really important for historians to appreciate this. And there's, of course we do. There's a great literature on failure in business and in technology. What do we do with failed technologies? And there's some fascinating cultural histories, as well as economic histories that we can do with that. I think there's real consequences, social consequences to leaving things out. And there's a tie-in here with this, aphorism about the winners write history, right? The things that emerge successfully or that triumph are the things that we remember and talk about. And we tend not to talk about, we tend not to remember the things that don't win out, the technologies that fall by the wayside, that are outside the boundaries of the consensus. This has real consequences for how we think about and talk about the internet, which we can talk about. But I think it's a more general problem in standardization. It's just sort of a natural feature of the process, inherent feature of the process.
Okay, great. Now, we're talking about how we take things for granted, perhaps the discursive and ideological implications of system building. I'm wondering, though, with standards, is there a danger of bias in standards at all?
Absolutely. So this is the sort of thing that when we think about different ways to make standards, we need to think really carefully about this. I think the professional standard setters have done a pretty good job at thinking about this, although the problems simply don't go away. So it's a matter of they deal with it in a couple of ways. The best way I think to talk about it is in terms of legitimacy. So bias is I think an important marker of a standard perhaps not being viewed as legitimate or as legitimate by as broad a population as one would like. The people talk about legitimacy and standardization talk about input legitimacy and output legitimacy. So what do they mean by that? Input legitimacy means that there's sufficient representation at the table. There's always a table involved here, usually metaphorically, but sometimes there's a real table. That there's not enough voices at the table, that there's not sufficient representation. And it's pretty easy to see how bias could come in at that level. So, for example, the main body in the United States today for voluntary consensus standards is ANSI, the American National Standards Institute. It was created just after, actually during World War I, just at the end. And for the first 20 or 30 years, there was no way for organized labor to be involved. It was a group dominated by trade associations and engineering societies with some representation from the federal government. But like much of American society in the 20s, there's, you know, labor, organized labor didn't have a voice. This changed with the Wagner Act in 1935, but I think it's still an open question about to what extent is labor's voice is heard in the creation of standards. This is something, by the way, parenthetically, if you really want to get someone worked up about standards, ask them about the Common Core education of standards. and if their points of view are incorporated in those standards, and then, you know, if you're smart, you should either duck or or sit back for a little bit, because the answer is going to be no. So input legitimacy is one way to think about it. The other way to think about it is output legitimacy. So, you know, we've accepted in democratic societies and representative governments that we can't logistically have everyone at the table. The question then is, can we have representatives setting rules for formal standards, for de jure standards, or consensus standards that take everyone's interests into account? And this is obviously tricky. You know, this is basically political history of the last couple hundred or thousand years, depending on your point of view. How we can do this well is you know, then people who are in law schools, you know, get interested in this. And it's about administrative procedures and rights of appeal, how to judge if a process is sufficiently representative, you know, these sorts of things. These are really important questions. I don't think there's any best answer for it. There are some interesting models, you know, back to this private governance question. There's some interesting models in from the voluntary consensus standards world that we can think about, groups that that see themselves as sufficiently representative and go really out of their way to try and eliminate bias. But, you know, again, as a historian, I think we gave up a long time ago on the notion that something could possibly be unbiased. There's always bias. The question is just, to what extent do we recognize those biases, and what can we do to overcome them? So there's winners and losers, no question about it.
So then, do or could standards promote or erect barriers to entry for new either associations or organizations or businesses, depending upon the standards?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. They can do this unconsciously or they can do it consciously. So there's, as a regulatory matter, this gets really interesting. We saw it, for example, in the Microsoft antitrust case in the 1990s. If Microsoft was, you know, to the antitrust people alleged, erecting exactly what you said, barriers to entry, especially for browser makers, right? Because of the standards and that they were building within the Microsoft operating system within Windows. So they did that on purpose, and the government regulators felt that this was important enough and clear enough that they should intervene. Sometimes in the voluntary committees and in the industry committees, some of the people who represent companies in those committees can be very skillful. And my book's got a lot of different stories about this. The folks from IBM in the 1960s and 1970s and 1980s emerge as particularly skillful in playing the game. And the way to do that is, you know, anyone who's listening or you who are familiar with committee work kind of have an intuitive sense about how to do this. You know, you set the agenda in certain ways, structure the process in certain ways to do your best and make alliances in certain ways to do your best to make sure that the outcome favors your own interests, and assume that everyone else is doing more or less the same thing. So there's real strategic it's unbelievable, actually, the strategies going on behind the scenes in these committees. So there's a real intentional way of doing that. There's also an interesting dynamic that this happens unintentionally sometimes, too. And so psychologists and organizational theorists have a pretty good handle on this. Irving Janis, a scholar whose work I didn't quite come to grips with until after I finished the book. But he's got a book called Groupthink. And it's, you know, a familiar notion if anyone's read, say, Ludwig Fleck and thought about thought collectives, or Kuhn later talking about similar, Thomas Kuhn talking about similar issues, that groups, social groups, cohere well when they have shared interests and they don't necessarily do a job, a good job shifting those interests too well. So a good example in this regard is the Internet Engineering Task Force, which sets standards for the Internet. And the way that it's trying to deal with some of the problems in security that Edward Snowden has revealed. And so cries went out right away. Bruce Schneier, amongst other people, said, we've got to re-engineer the internet. And, you know, it's not that easy for a standards body like the IETF to just shift directions that quickly. They're used to doing things in a certain way, both organizationally, and there's a sociological aspect of groupthink there, where, you know, they're not going to change their mindset quickly. So this is lock-in, you know, a sort of deep example of lock-in that economists talk about. It can be a real problem. It can lead to stagnation, certainly, both in terms of technology and culturally as well.
Great. So the current debates on openness, the current debates dealing with openness and open standards? I know you just mentioned Snowden and some of the ideas about re-engineering the internet. Can you perhaps elaborate on some more openness debates that are popping up with relations to standards and digital communication networks?
Sure. So the two, I mean, there's so many that it's been tricky to follow closely. The production schedule for the book has, you know, been, like most academic books, a little slower than I would like. And so in the early phases, I would see things like this pop up in the news and think, oh no, my moment's here and it's gone. And then they keep coming up. So you know, optimistically, I think this might mean that my analysis has some legs. Hopefully that's true. I don't follow all of them that closely, but two I have followed. So Snowden and then the net neutrality debate, or what's been recast as debate over the open internet. So Snowden, I think, you know, has been talked about a lot, and it is a great example of the central irony of openness and transparency, where on the first page of my book, I talk about this open government executive order, essentially, that Obama issued on his first day of office. I've got it here. He says, we will work together to ensure the public trust and establish a system of transparency, public participation, and collaboration. Openness will strengthen our democracy and promote efficiency and effectiveness in government. It's the Open Government Initiative. It's really the perfect statement of the different, political values of openness. You don't need me to tell you that his government hasn't quite lived up to it. And it's, you know, it's not just Snowden, it's all over the place. And I make this statement not blaming him personally or the people who work for him, who I think are probably pretty good public servants. It's just kind of the nature of the beast. There's just some things, especially in national security, it's a real uncomfortable area that Snowden's opened up for us, that governments want to keep secret, need to keep secret, have always kept secret. You know, we can agree or disagree about whether they should be keeping secrets or not, but you know, this is kind of the problem. And there's a big debate about it, as you know, that's kind of an understatement. I think the most sensible voices in the debate, Snowden's actually one of them. I saw him appear via robot in a TED Talk, an interview with, I think it was Chris Anderson, in the past week or so. And he supports the national security state. His criticisms get into some of these process issues that I was talking about before in response to your issues about bias, which is that, you know, we need better review mechanisms. We need more transparency somewhere in the system. You know, you and I probably shouldn't know exactly what American spies or Russian spies or Chinese spies are doing, but we could probably feel better about the way that our government is accountable, at least in some way, about you know, reporting that and about knowing what's going on. So, you know, Snowden's not out on some left or right wing about this. I think he's kind of in a pretty comfortable middle area, pretty sensible middle area. The second example that I mentioned is network neutrality or the open internet. And here's an example where I think historians can make a really useful contribution, and where getting the history right really matters. And I get into this a little bit in the book's conclusion. If we don't understand how the internet came to be, or how other computer networks came into existence, or that the TCP/IP internet emerged as one design amongst many designs for different types of networks, and why it emerged that way, and the quick answer is because of heavy Department of Defense subsidies, kind of skewed market forces. If we don't account for that, and then we're going to you know, make some kind of mistaken assumptions about the internet. And there's a really, I think a really good way to think about this is to ask the question, when did the internet become open? It wasn't always talked about as an open system. It was only in the early 1990s that that people started talking about the open internet. You know, if you can search for it on Google or your favorite search engine. They borrowed this term from a rival networking system called Open Systems Interconnection. That's the subject of Chapter 7 in my book, an international collaboration of researchers trying to build a consensus computer networking architecture. That crashed and burned for reasons we can get into, and the internet flourished because the Department of Defense was funding it lavishly, and then caught on because it was free. It had been subsidized, so you know, there's no cost to adopt it. So there's this veneer from the vantage point of the end user of freedom and openness in the internet, even though its origins are you know, anything but free, and it came from what Paul Edwards has usefully called the closed world, right? The military-industrial academic complex of Cold War America. So I read debates about, you know, I read the op-ed pages and it drives me nuts a little bit, because they say the internet's always been open, which is just, you know, factually, empirically not true. Or people try and marshal origin myths about the internet. So this is really irritating exchange on the op-ed pages of the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal last year, where Stephen Johnson, a technology writer, said, "The internet, we invented that," as if you know, you and I and Stephen Johnson and my friends with our laptops could invent a technological system like the internet, which is, you know, again, plainly not true. And then Gordon Krovitz, this guy, a former publisher of the Wall Street Journal, basically said, no, private capital invented that, and somehow credited Xerox PARC with the invention of the internet, which, again, doesn't stand up to basic, you know, undergrad level history scrutiny. high school level scrutiny. Wikipedia, you know, I mean, it's it's not bad. So, so the way we talk about these things, I think, is influenced by the stories we tell about their origins. So then, how does this fit into contemporary discussions? Well, I think if we knew about net neutrality and about the open internet, I think if we knew a little bit more about this history and knew about the big, big money behind not only the internet, but different failed alternatives for networking architectures, we'd understand that this issue is not quite as simple as I want Netflix or I want Hulu. That there's this really complex, mostly obscure set of relationships and alliances, not only around standards and technical things, but also economic arrangements. And so some of the better commentary about net neutrality gets at this a little bit. And we're starting to see it a little bit more in the public view because, you know, we're reading about agreements between Netflix and Comcast. And people are starting to get the sense or starting to hear of companies like Level 3 or Cogent or other, backhaul type providers. And so I think that's a more realistic conversation to have. I'm skeptical of people who say we need to keep the internet open so that, you know, Verizon, who you don't like because they charge you too much money or something, that's the person you pay, is going to block you from somebody else. I don't think that's a helpful way to parse the issue. And, you know, it's very useful rhetoric, but it's not a helpful way to promote greater understanding of the issue.
Sure. Now, if a person wanted to purchase your book and to really read about the history and some historical origins related to the debates on standardization and openness and open standards, what, if you had to give a short blurb about your book for the person looking for a book about these issues, what would you say? Or could you come up with something?
Sure. I mean, the question is, how did openness become so central to the way we talk about communication networks and information networks in the 21st century, in the digital age? It wasn't always this way. If we look at communication networks of previous centuries and in the recent past, they're characterized by regimes of centralized control, either monopoly control in the Bell system, telephone system, or government control of the ARPANET, and which emerged into the internet. And so that transition takes some explaining historically. So what they'll take away from it is that they'll get kind of an antidote to the rhetoric and perceptions that the digital age is something all new. They'll see that many of the practices from the digital that we associate with the digital age, many of the ideas like openness, have long historical roots. And there's a long tradition of people talking about the various advantages and problems of centralized or decentralized control over technological systems.
And when can we expect the book on the shelves?
I'm told April 4th. I'm told that that's when it will come. So I'm hoping that they're sticking to that. The date slipped a couple of times, in production. So I'm sure they're just making sure it's perfect. But I think it should be within a couple of weeks. I actually saw and have in my hands bound proofs that the publisher sent to a conference that I attended a couple weeks ago, the Business History Conference. So it looks like a book. It's the uncorrected proof, so it's not quite the real thing. But Cambridge is coming out with it. My publisher's Cambridge University Press. They've got paperback and hardback copies available. And it's on sale on Amazon and all of your favorite online booksellers. There's a discount code, which I'm going to post on my website that Cambridge, encouraged me to do. If you buy the book through Cambridge, it's 20% off. And that will be on my website, which is arussell.org/open. So you know, I encourage people to take a look, hopefully get it from their library. Let me know what you think, and enjoy it.
Thank you very much. Well, that's Open Standards and the Digital Age. Thank you, Dr. Russell, for appearing on the show.
Thanks. I really appreciate the opportunity and the time you spent with me. We'll be right back.